Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It's Tuesday, January 28th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning, Congressman Jill Takuda joins us to talk about navigating the choppy waters in Washington, D.C. What's at risk at home in the wake of the president's executive orders? We also check in with University of Hawaii President Wendy Hensel as she adjusts to her new job and the changes that a new Republican administration in the White House could bring to federally funded programs. We learn about a Waihewa charter school on shaky grounds that is on the verge of closing its doors and shaking things up in Oahu's community gardens. After 40 years, the city's tilling over the rules as demand for a piece of earth grows. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. President Donald Trump has signed 50 executive orders, like bucket shot. So where do you begin? Republicans push Democrats out of the White House, and the margins in the House and the Senate are razor thin. This morning, Democratic Congresswoman Jill Takuda joined us in our studio to talk about the state of affairs in our nation's capital.
It's been absolute chaos, to your point. From the moment he got sworn into office, stacks of executive orders that you saw on his desk that he's signing, from the most frivolous things like renaming gulfs to serious, serious things like pausing and halting federal funding that goes to, in many cases, life-saving services to the public. You know, I'm hearing from colleagues across the country where domestic violence centers aren't sure if they can keep their doors open. You've got firefighters worrying about whether they'll have FEMA reimbursements. You know, you have a hiring freeze going on right now, jobs being rescinded, people being fired in ways that are absolutely illegal and unconstitutional. I think that is the crux of the matter here, that what we're seeing with all of these swirls of executive orders, there has definitely been breaches of that separation of powers that has long defined this country, having that balance between the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. Right now, he's running roughshod over all of us, quite frankly, and trying to see just what he can get away with. And so while there's a lot of panic in the air, it's also going to be really incumbent on the legislative and, quite frankly, the judicial branch to have the courage to push back and lean in and make sure we protect what is constitutionally our right. For example, for the Congress, the power of the purse, not being able to halt the federal fundings that you're talking about to grants and to loans, absolutely, 100% should not be happening.
And, you know, we have seen action being taken by our attorney general here, joining other states, you know, in pushing back.
Yes, absolutely. And the states are going to need to do that. Well, we'll need to have our courts that have, again, that courage to stand up against Trump. He is banking on a Supreme Court of his choosing, holding it, you know, kind of siding with him, if you will. They need to look to the Constitution, what they all took an oath to, what they were sworn to do. If they do, the answer is very clear. And Trump's going to find himself without that support at the Supreme Court level.
Well, what do you see as the most critical of the folks that are teetering on the edge with this latest decision to freeze all loans and grants?
We're getting it rolling in day by day in terms of the impacts, even locally, that it's having. But the bottom line is the power of the purse rests with Congress. And the fact that, you know, Trump is really testing the boundaries, he's really trying to push against that Impoundment Control Act, really shows that he wants to control it all. He wants to take the power of the purse for himself. He wants to expand, you know, the authority of the presidency. He wants to see if his Supreme Court will give him that ability. They absolutely must say no. Even Republicans across this country have to recognize that him halting grants and loans have hurt both red states and blue states and purple states, right? This does not discriminate. And so if it's about taking care of our people and making sure our legislative intent and will is heard as Congress, then they must not allow Trump to continue in this matter.
Well, you know, I know it's a busy time. We've got the hearings for his nominees, you know, so our senators are busy with that.
Yes.
But of his appointments, what are you most concerned about?
There's so many concerning things, I will say. And I think the word that just keeps coming to me today as we talk about everything from executive orders to confirmations, it is courage. It's going to take political courage for the Senate to really stand up and ask the hard questions that need to be asked. Quite frankly, the fact that we have a Secretary of Defense that passed on a tie vote, this is the person that's in charge of our national security, represents us, you know, amongst world powers and world leaders, both allies and adversaries. To have it be done by a tie-breaking is unheard of to me. And this week, as they face some critical, critical confirmations, both for Health and Human Services, well as, yes, someone right here from Hawaii, Director of National Intelligence, they need to have the courage to ask the real question as to whether or not this is about doing what's right for the American people and our Constitution, or just doing whatever Donald Trump says. I recall from Maisie's testimony and when she was questioning Hegseth in his confirmation, he told her at one point, whatever the president wants. And I feel that is a sad statement if every single conferee going forward is under that whole mandate of whatever the president wants. It's not whatever the president wants. It's what's best for the American people and our country.
Yes. And I think that people want leaders in place who are competent and who have the wherewithal and the capacity and the experience. And I think, you know, that's one of the criticisms that we've heard with Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard, you know, RF Kennedy, some of the, you know, more controversial picks.
Absolutely. You can't lead what you don't know. And none of these are learn on the job kind of positions, especially when we're talking about national security. Tulsi's never had any intelligence experience. And even beyond that, if we think to the very critical issues and positions she has taken over time and how she's flip-flopped back and forth, even flip-flopped on national security and intelligence questions and positions, can you trust her? The DNI has to be someone that the president trusts wholeheartedly, Congress trusts, quite frankly, our world allies trust with their secrets and us sharing secrets back and forth. If someone flip-flops to the whim of whomever she's trying to please at the moment, that does not instill confidence or trust. That makes America vulnerable.
And that was part of a conversation we had with our representative of Congress, Jill Takuda, earlier this morning. Tulsi Gabbard's confirmation hearing for Director of National Intelligence is set for January 30th. We will have more with Takuda right after a short break. Let's get back to our conversation with Jill Takuda, who stopped by our studios this morning. Our senators are deep into the confirmation hearings of President Trump's cabinet picks, and our House representatives are back here at home meeting with constituents trying to navigate the impact of the executive orders issued by the president in the last week. But what about affordability issues that we here in Hawaii face? What more can be done in that arena? Here's Takuda.
That is, first and foremost, what I go to Congress for. And you and I have talked about this, the fact that it is about all of our children, our grandchildren, my kids, whether they're going to be able to have homes here in Hawaii, build a life here. And with all the pressures we've always felt for far too long in Hawaii, the cost of living, the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare, which is deeply personal to me and something that I'm very involved in, co-leading the Bipartisan Rural Health Caucus, we've got to ease that burden. We heard a lot from President Trump on the campaign trail that he was going to be talking about reducing that burden, that everyday cost of living for everyday Americans. If that's really, truly what he wants to do, I'm 100% on board. We have to do that. But everything I've seen to date, whether it's threatening to take over Greenland or changing the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, whether it's putting thousands of troops at the border, all of these different things, that's not bringing down the cost of eggs. That's not helping someone figure out if they can rent or buy a home or if they have to move away. Let's start talking about the real things that matter. which are those kitchen table issues that all of our families, all of our neighbors, all of us care deeply about, not this other stuff that, quite frankly, is a distraction and not helping our people.
I was going to ask that because there's so much distraction right now, zeroing in on the things. There was an article in the Honolulu Star Advertiser about the military personnel and their dependents and the rental situation here. It was 14% of what they rent here in the market.
Yeah. You know, that was a report that I called for in the National Defense Authorization Act, and I was extremely disappointed at the results. The best thing out of that was the fact that we found out that 14% of our rental market is being taken by service members and their family. I expected a lot more from our Department of Defense in terms of giving us some real solutions to that. You can't throw something like that out into the room and not have a huge impact and just walk away. It's about taking that responsibility as well in terms of how we are going to address what has been a major, major impact on our already limited housing inventory here in Hawaii. How are you going to build up, build more? How are you going to make sure that of the service members here in Hawaii, which, yes, they need a place to live too, that you are going to take care of them without negatively impacting our local families as well? And so I expected a lot more. I'm going to keep pushing more because that is absolutely an unacceptable number. I don't know that there's even an acceptable percentage, quite frankly. But if you're impacting our housing inventory, you have an absolute responsibility to assist us in finding solutions.
In the case of those military families, you know, they do get a housing allowance. Mm-hmm. And so the landlords look at them as attractive tenants because they know they're good for their money. If there's any trouble, they can run it up to command. Mm-hmm. They like those renters. But at the same time, it hurts the local families that are looking for a place to rent that they can afford.
Absolutely. It's not like we have endless land and endless housing options. And so given that, and they all know that, we all know the situation in Hawaii when it comes to housing, then they need to be that good neighbor and assist us in whether it's building out, whether it's finding new opportunities or places where military families can live without impacting our local families, or quite frankly, build to our local population and civilian military population as well. Again, I expected a lot more than what we got. But if there was one good thing that we finally got out there was that they are, in fact, having a significant impact on our housing market. It's always been an anecdotal thing. We think about it. We say it. Oh, you know, people rent to the military instead of local families. Now we've got a number to point to, and we know it's significant, and we've got to do something.
You know, I was traveling last year and went to Guam and got a sense of a situation there because there's a tremendous military buildup on that island. And as I got off to the airport, baggage claim was all torn up. Mm. And I was asking my family, oh, that was a terrible first impression. You know, what's up with that? Why don't they fix it? And they said, oh, that's from the typhoon from a year and a half ago. Yeah. But all the contractors are working on military bases because they're trying to build up those projects, $1 billion defense contracts. And so that's where all the workers are. Even the lieutenant governor was lamenting he can't get any work done on his house because the priority is all the military housing. So it does have an effect on local communities wherever, you know, you're at in the Pacific.
Absolutely. And I think that's where at times, and I've often pushed, the DOD has to take a step back. They're always focused first and foremost on that readiness posture. And so the bases and the runways, and yes, that is very important. But remember, you can't do anything without, in many cases, the civilian population that is supporting you, that's coming to your aid to assist you in that readiness posture. And so take a look at how you can improve their quality of life as well. You are not just inhabiting a base. You're a neighbor, you're a guest on an island. And so treat that island as a home. Understand that part of it is also fixing up and repairing what is broken. It's easy to just focus on the military aspect. We've got to look at it as a whole of government approach when it comes to wherever we are in our own country, or across the globe, quite frankly. We've never been very good at that, being that good neighbor and looking as it is a whole of government approach to how we reside in any one particular community. But we've got to. We've got to do better.
When we last talked, we did chat about agriculture. Where are we at with the farm bill?
I wish I could say we had one. We were supposed to have one 2 years ago. We are once again embarking on another year extension going in towards the farm bill. Very pleased to announce that I am the ranking member, the lead Democrat on the Conservation Research and Biotechnology Subcommittee, which is really important for Hawaii. That's all of the invasive species, pesticide work, conservation, really looking at research to how we combat diseases or we find better ways to produce agriculture. So that was a really important thing for me to get into that leadership position for that subcommittee. But we have got to push hard and make sure this farm bill is one that does not compromise what is most important to us. And as you might recall, last year, the reason we came to stalemate was because there were significant cuts they wanted to make to food programs, to SNAP, which was an absolute hard red line for all of us. They wanted to cut conservation programs and dollars as well, which we know in Hawaii, climate change isn't waiting for us to get our act together. They're not waiting for us to convince everyone in the country that climate chaos is real. All the while, literally, our country is on fire. There are floods. There's tornadoes. There's extreme weather conditions. All of these different things. We just look in Hawaii. We have erosion issues. We have wildfire threats. We have all of these different things happening. It's not by chance. This is climate change. And so to really cut back significantly on those conservation dollars and programs that have really been allowing us to start to make gains and start to mitigate this chaos, that will be foolhardy. Absolutely. And so this is about going into the farm bill and pushing to make sure the right things are included and the bad things are not.
Yeah. I mean, biosecurity, food security, those kinds of things, mm-hmm. all a major threat to mm-hmm. our island state. We're just vulnerable. You know, we just had that designation by the Department of Commerce for the economic development mm-hmm. zone. You know, we're hopeful that that will help at a time when things are getting paused and cut.
Absolutely. And I think right now, too, at the federal level, making sure all of those things that were designated stick. But in Hawaii, we know we have the ingenuity, the innovation to do things differently, to adapt, to be creative, to be resilient. And I think in many cases, we have been recognized as let's invest in Hawaii. We've got to continue to push us that Hawaii is a place to invest in because we can be innovative. We can find new solutions and ways to be resilient. That's what we're going to have to do going forward into the future, whether it's how we feed ourselves, whether we look at it from an economic diversification standpoint, all of these different aspects. And so I think there's so much opportunity. While, yes, there's chaos right now, the hope is going to be to continue forward and really make sure people recognize that Hawaii is a place of opportunity. Invest of us because we could help lead not just the country, but the world in so many different things.
Are there any particular projects that are on your radar right now? Rail funding or anything else?
You know, the list is long, as we started talking about from the very beginning, in terms of all the executive orders, trying to protect those things that mean the most for our rural communities, especially. I represent CD2, which is all of our neighbor islands. And so for me, it's very bread and butter kinds of things I'm worried about. Things like air transportation for Molokai and Lanai. I went to Lanai this, you know, weekend on another airline, and I took a ferry to Maui to get back home to Oahu on another air carrier. Spoke with folks about the real impacts that, you know, what happens when you're stranded on an island. Not many of us think about that, but can you get the emergency care you need? Can you get the medication you need, the food that you need? Can you get to, you know, can your kid get to a school opportunity that could really make a difference for them? All of these different things. I had a veteran tell me that he just wasn't going to get the care he needed because it was too much trouble to try to be able to make the flights all the time. This is absolutely unacceptable. And so, you know, as you probably know, the last few weeks have been very, very difficult. And to me, we almost have to mandate, and if it takes that, we should mandate at Congress that if you have essential air service contracts, there must be a contingency plan that makes sure people can get on and off the island, get to and from where they need to go, despite the fact that a plane or planes completely might be grounded. And I think that is absolutely 100% what we need to start doing.
Do you think the solution is extending the runway? Is the answer in DOT's hands?
I think it's in all of our hands. You know, I know it's easy to point fingers like, okay, it's the state's issue or it's the county's issue. I don't think extending the runway is the simplest solution or the easiest solution, quite frankly. I think we have got to look at how we can get carriers making sure that air lift is possible. But let's be real here. Sometimes even air transportation is difficult going to Molokai and Lanai. Are we looking at sea options as well? I have long been supporting Maui County's initiative to take a look at purchasing the ferry for county operation. If we can get a government-run and owned a ferry, we can put federal highway funds toward it. We can subsidize this. And so I think we've got to look at multiple modes of transportation to get people on and off the island, and we've got to plan ahead. Too often, we're responding to a crisis, and that's where it gets really difficult, where you see people in emergency situations thrown on fishing boats to get to Oahu. That's not right. We've got to plan ahead, all levels of government and the carriers, to talk about how we can make sure there's multiple ways that individuals can get on and off the island. Again, these are essential air service contracts in many cases we are talking about. Essential. So how do we make sure if that's not working and it's not running, people have a way to get where they need to go?
That was Democratic Congresswoman Jill Takuda, who represents District 2, which covers much of the rural areas in the state. More to come on the executive orders. Stay with us. One of President Trump's targets is the U.S. Department of Education. Earlier this month, we heard from Hawaii School Superintendent and Board Chair about their concerns for lower education. But how's the view for higher education? This morning, we talked to University of Hawaii President Wendy Hensel, who essentially says, stay calm. Blowing up the Education Department isn't going to be as easy as President Trump might think.
That would require a lot of work and a lot of time in order to dismantle the Department of Education. So what that looks like, I mean, there are certain functions that have to be carried out by law that maybe they'd be moved to another department, but they would still exist. So I think it's too early to really have a sense of what that would look like or what the impact will be. And I haven't seen any movement toward that specifically as of yet, even with the flurry of executive orders over the last week.
I think the latest one is about how there's a freeze on grants and loans. And so I don't know what is tied up with that that affects the university, because you've got lots of, you know, research projects, you know, there's financial aid. How is your administration looking at this?
We're focusing on it intensely, as you can imagine, to make sure that we understand what's implicated, the breadth of the activities that may be affected and impacted, but also importantly, not to overreact as these directives come out. You know, we want to give our federal partners time to evaluate what it means so that they can help us understand that as well. But certainly we are all communicating across the university and laser focused on how to ensure that the university stays strong despite any challenges in terms of our funding.
Is there anything that you see as teetering on the edge right now?
Well, certainly we're concerned about the directive to put a freeze on federal funds. You know, again, what does that mean in real time? How long will that last? Is it temporary? Will it have a longer term impact? I think no one has the answers to those things. In fact, I was informed that many of our agency partners, the NIH, Department of Defense, they're having meetings as we speak to try and identify what the real world impact of this means and then to communicate it to us and other universities around the country. So, you know, we're in a wait and see mode while we both plan how to respond, depending on what information we receive.
And, you know, I've read stories about how spending for external communication, and I think with the National Institutes of Health, there were meetings and conferences that were planned that all of a sudden just got paused.
Yeah, it's certainly a new day, and there's a lot of respectful wariness to make sure that we understand what is the direction coming out of Washington, and how does it affect us and our students and our community.
And there are a number of grants tied to green energy through the DARPA, you know, defense contracts, whether it's wave energy or other things. Is it still just wait and see? No indication yet that those have been paused?
Well, I think everything has been paused. That's the issue, is how what is the scope and the scale of the pause, and how long will the pause last? As the administration and the different executive agencies assess how the money is being spent. You know, and there are legal implications for money that's already been committed by contract and extremely complex issues that are now in play. And I think the most important thing for us is neither to overreact or underreact, but to monitor intently have a strategy going forward, no matter what comes out of these discussions, and just ensure that we're prepared. But truly, it's less than 24 hours since this came out, and so we're very much in investigation mode and trying to understand what it really means for our community.
You know, there's a lot of talk around workforce development, and I know the university has been ramping up, you know, to make sure that we've got programs in place to boost our numbers in the nursing school. And oh, by the way, I understand that the nursing school got a nice acknowledgement for being one of the top in the country.
Yes, wonderful. We're super excited about that.
Any indication on whether that's going to be stymied? You know, because I imagine, you know, you're going to have to weigh things with the asks over at the state legislature.
Certainly, you know, we've had many offers of assistance from the state legislature. Again, as we figure out what is the impact of the federal decisions that are being made in real time by the Trump administration. And we really appreciate that. It's just, I wish I could give you more information. I think everybody wants more information. It's just, this is evolving in real time and the stakes are high. So we want to make sure that we're communicating accurate information going forward. But certainly at the moment, you know, the directive is pretty sweeping and we need to figure out how we move forward with our important initiatives, including workforce development, in light of that.
I'm just thinking there's been really good momentum, you know, whether it's boosting the faculty at the nursing school to get more
right.
nursing students in, you know, to get those nurses trained and working in our hospital so we don't have to keep bringing people in from the mainland on these temporary contracts. So no indication yet. I mean, you know, I just worry about, well, what's this going to mean for a student, let's say, that's waiting on financial aid to get into a certain program?
Right. Well, my understanding from the directive is it does not affect individual financial assistance. And so, you know, what the scale of that exemption is, we're still not sure. But I think that has been exempted from the pause, which I think makes sense. Important to remember, we receive significant funding for our activities from the state. You know, the majority of our general funds come from the state, and the state also has different protections and interests that we are moving forward simultaneously with the federal funding and the federal initiatives that we're pursuing. So that's what I mean by it's complicated. It's all very interwoven, and detangling what this affects and how significant the effects are will take a little time. So we want to be very, very careful in communicating what the impact of these orders is.
And so how was the first couple of weeks here of the session for you? Really interesting for opening day.
Yeah, well, it certainly was. You know, I appreciated the invitation as a guest. There was some communication that I didn't exactly expect to hear publicly aired in that setting. But listen, this is politics. This is high stakes where everybody is interested in the work that we do and who holds these positions. So if I wasn't prepared to deal with that, I wouldn't have signed on for the job. So what I can say is a vast, overwhelming folks that I have met have been supportive, are deeply vested in my success as the university's success. And I have really appreciated both outreach by the governor and Mayor Blangiardi. It's been truly astonishing how warm that welcome has been. So that's what I'll be focused on, and certainly that's what will keep us going.
Well, you know, I don't know if you were referencing questions about athletics, given the flap over the release of the athletic director under President David Lasseter, and, you know, trying to regroup and move forward. I don't know, anything you want to add on that front?
Well, the legislature, I've said this repeatedly, has a legitimate interest in our activities. You know, what are we good stewards of our funds? Are we advancing our programs in ways that is in alignment with our values and the accountability that we expect from public stakeholders? So I don't think any of those questions were a surprise. Certainly, I'm not surprised by the interest in the appointment of the next athletic director or the variety of issues surrounding athletics. It is an incredibly fast-moving pace with the NCAA and the changes that every time I open my email, it seems like another decision is coming down that will impact us. So, you know, we're just focused on how to create an excellent D1 program and how do we engage people to make sure that that happens and how do we hire the very best person to to take us and create that vision into the future. I think no surprises there, all very much expected.
And are you enjoying the view from your office? I know David Lastner said that's one thing he will miss.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Beautiful day outside, beautiful trees. You know, the campus is an arboretum itself, so it's absolutely gorgeous. And at moments like this, when we feel like every day we are receiving new information of challenging issues, it's nice to take a deep breath and look outside and remember the place that we're in and the significance of the place that we're in. So, yes, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Any nice surprises? I mean, something that you didn't expect in this first month on the job?
So many. I don't know if it's a surprise, but just the warmth of the welcome has been extraordinary. You know, yesterday I was on Kapi'olani Community College's campus, and I don't know if you remember in the morning, there was a absolute pouring rain shower coming down. And nevertheless, it had to be, gosh, at least 30 people out in the rain for the Native Hawaiian welcome protocol, singing, chanting, playing the drums. And we all stood there in the pouring rain. And it was an incredible bonding experience. You know, it wasn't like we were trying to avoid getting wet. And pretty quickly, we realized that was impossible. it really was a wonderful moment. So I just repeatedly am touched by the warmth and the investment of this community and the university's success. So it's really been touching.
Well, you were blessed.
Absolutely. I'm told it is a good omen. And Pears, we keep getting good omens because it's been raining a lot while we've been out there. So.
Yeah, and pretty cold too, I must say. Well, at least for our standards.
I have to disagree with you. I just have to talk to my friends at home who say it is in some places, you know, literally zero right now to say, you know, the high 60s, low 70s, not so bad.
Well, we'll chat again after your blood is thinned out.
Yeah, exactly.
But thank you so much, President Hensel.
Of course. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
That was University of Hawaii President Wendy Hensel talking to us this morning about the potential impacts that the many executive orders that the president has signed could have on operations here in the islands. She says the Departments of Defense and Energy and others are currently meeting to assess the short-term and long-term effects of the latest freeze on federal loan and grant programs. Waihoua Charter School is on thin ice. That's Honolulu Civil Beat's lead story today. Here to talk about it is politics editor Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Nice to hear from you.
Nice to be on your program again. Reunited, and it feels so good.
Yeah, I haven't chatted with you for a while. But so what can you tell us about this story?
Well, it's remarkable. Megan Tagami, our education reporter, has it up as on our site today, and it's close to being the number one story. It got such interest. Basically, Kamalani Academy, which has been in trouble for a while now, it's been audited. There's financial problems. Well, the state made a decision last week to say that they're going to close it by the end of the year. So it's open for at least this year. Whether it's going to be open in the future remains to be seen. We don't know whether there's going to be appeal on the part of the school. But here are the main reasons for the closure, according to the state. There's financial statements that are missing. There are checks that have not been deposited. There are school funds that have been used for apparently questionable purposes like first-class travel. And there's also a dwindling enrollment. And the school cannot explain why they have spent half of their student fundings so far. They have missed rent payments. This may be one of the biggest problems of all. And they have been battling the nonprofit from whom they lease the property there in Waihoua. So many problems outlined in the story regarding Kamalani.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that they had issues before with their
right.
online program. And, you know, I think the Charter School Commission, you know, gave them some heat over that. But then they got a reprieve. You know, they appealed the decision, and I thought they were back on track.
Yeah, it seemed that way as well. And you know, they put $2 million in repairs into these facilities, but to do that, they had to take out a loan for that. You cannot accrue debt. A loan is something somewhat different. There is some dispute about whether the rent is too high for the Wahiawa facility, but I think the larger point that Megan makes is that what's happening at Kamalani Academy, it really illustrates a longstanding challenge that the state of Hawaii has in overseeing charter schools, particularly regarding their finances and their facilities. Remember, the purpose of charter schools, and this goes back to 1994 when the program was set up, is you want to give them greater flexibility. That includes the curriculum. You want to adapt the school to the students, help them with, you know, a learning environment that fits them, that fits their passions regarding education. There are 37 schools total, charter schools total in Hawaii. So far, two of them have lost their charter. Kamalani would make the third school should this closure stick.
Yes, and those other schools I know had problems with oversight, you know, and questionable spending. But, you know, you would think that, you know, after those problems got aired out, that, you know, the other schools would be on best behavior and, you know, there's best practices that they need to be following.
Right. With Kamalani in particular, they were singled out in an audit in 2023, another one in 2024. By the way, there's actually a state law that mandates the shutdown of a charter school if payroll is not met. We do know that at least four principals cycled through Kamalani within a two-year period. That's pretty shocking in terms of turnover. Megan was not able to get any official comment about what's going on, certainly not from the nonprofit that leases the facility. But she did talk to one expert, well, Catherine Payne. Remember, she ran the department, the Board of Education, and herself, a former educator. She said, you know, really what this comes down to, and others that Megan talked to, is financial transparency. It really is key. That's coming from a former director of the Charter Commission as well. So that is something I think that the story is going to highlight. And I wouldn't be surprised if this comes up at the legislative session, which, of course, is already convened. And as you know, education bills are always at the top of funding is always the major concern. Remember, when you lose enrollment, you lose funding for the schools. So a lot of issues involved here. And kudos to Megan Tagami for getting the latest on Kamalani Academy.
Yeah, it's a shame that the school may have to close its doors because the whole idea behind charter schools, right? Like you said, more flexibility, variety of curriculum. So we'll just have to see what happens. But thank you, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Well, we've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beach Chad Blair about a Wahiawa charter school that is on shaky ground with the Charter School Commission and could be forced to close its doors later this year. Read about it at HonoluluCivilBeat.org.
HPR celebrates the life of our former president and general manager and my dear friend, Jose Fajardo. Join me, Ray Cruz, for a special two-hour Latin Beat tribute. Get ready to dance and have fun. It's what Jose would have wanted. Join me Friday evening at 8 p.m. here on HPR 1. See you then.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Alan Bromley, At the Edge of Forever, mixed-media print-based works that explore themes such as memory, loss, and the environment. HonoluluMuseum.org.
change may be coming to a community garden near you. There are 11 gardens under the city's control, and it's holding a public hearing later today about revising the rules for the community garden program. Those rules were last amended in 1984 and are overdue for an overhaul. Anna Mines is the community garden project manager for the City Parks Department. She spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the need to standardize the rules.
So we have 11 community gardens across the island. Most of them are in the urban core, but we also have one in Wahiawa and Hawaii Kai and Kaneohe. And we are serving about 1,200 plots in those gardens. The number does fluctuate because we are some gardens, when a plot becomes available, they're deciding to divide it into two smaller plots because some people want to garden a smaller space, which is really great. So that's why I don't have a specific number. We are serving probably about 2,000 people in this program, and that's also not very specific because we don't have the applications ourselves. That's managed by gardeners, garden officers at the gardens themselves. But we can guesstimate that it's about two people per plot or less, and so about 2,000 people. And the gardens, you know, they do vary in a lot of ways. Most of them have 10 by 10 foot plots, but, you know, even Wahiawa is a nice outlier, and the community garden out there has 20 by 40 feet plots. So it's almost like more of a farm plot than it is a garden plot. Mm. And the program was founded in 1975 under the Fossey administration with the intent of providing garden space, recreational garden activity to people who don't have access to land. And that's why we have most of them in the urban core, because that's where you see a lot of people living in apartment buildings or condominiums. And so they emerged over those decades to provide land space to residents of Honolulu and Oahu, you know, with a very specific intention of being recreational. We are the Department of Parks and Recreation. Gardening is recognized as one of the most common recreational activities out there, and it serves so many benefits, you know, mental health, physical health, being outdoors, being in community, getting to know your neighbor. And then food is a side outcome of that. It's like a side benefit. Not everyone is growing food. A lot of people grow succulents or flowers, maybe lay flowers. Maybe they are growing herbs, or, you know, maybe they aren't growing anything at all, but they're like using their space to be outside, right, and being in their plot. And all of that is okay. It's meant to be accessible to people who have all kinds of gardening styles and experience. They don't have to know how to grow food. They don't have to be growing food. But we are learning, and partially was something we found in this community garden survey that we just are wrapping up now, that people are relying on their plot for food.
So getting into these new guidelines, I think I read that they hadn't been updated since the 80s. And that kind of seems in need of refurbishing. What are some of the priorities of what these guidelines are meant to address?
So first, I'll use the word rules and regulations. And I'm being very specific in that because we have guidelines and they're not necessarily enforceable. They don't follow rulemaking procedures. The rules and regulations do follow rulemaking procedures, which means we can enforce on them. The old rules and regulations that were last updated in 1984, while they were probably adequate at the time, over the last, 40 years, there's a lot of gaps that have been recognized. And the individual gardens have done a really great job of creating bylaws to fill in those gaps. But creating bylaws, while really good communication tools and pretty effective for the most part in actually helping the garden be run, they're not legally enforceable because they didn't follow the rulemaking procedures, the policies and laws that we have for the government, for government-run programs to make rules.
And they're not standardized.
They're not standardized. And there's a certain amount that we don't need to be standardized. We want to be able to allow for nuance between gardens because they have different communities, different needs, different sizes, different times of the month they want to meet. Like, we want to be able to provide flexibility within these rules for nuanced bylaws at individual gardens. And we do have materials on our website that kind of goes into the details of what garden bylaws could be used for with these new rules. But yes, having some consistency across the program with the intent of being able to enforce on them and back up our officers when they, you know, are ready to revoke a plot permit. In the past, that's been hard, and that can be frustrating for our officers. But with these standardized, legally created rules, we can do that.
Broadly speaking, what are those gaps?
So many things. I mean, almost everything. Like the 1984 rules and regulations are about 5 pages, tiny page, half pages. And the proposed draft is 36. That may change when we go for adoption. But as it stands, it's, you know, 7 times as much. And really the content gets to the heart of, you know, what a lot of our officers are hoping to have clarity on, which is, can you have a tree in your plot? Some gardens in their bylaws have created limitations to that. And we've modeled our new rules after those bylaws because trees have created issues. And we want to address that and be proactive and have in our proposed rules a limitation to trees, which I also like mentioning because I think this is the most controversial change. We love trees. I work in the Division of Urban Forestry. We are all a bunch of tree lovers, and it's kind of a shame to be able to not to have trees in our plots. But the cons outweigh the pros in this case, just because of the allotment style model. But just to give an example, there was no description within the old rules about what you can and can't plant, whether or not you can have a fence, how high that fence can be. There wasn't really rules about when to meet, how to meet.
And so what are you planning on doing to address the wait list, which I know is hundreds of people deep? Some people have been on it for years at this point. So that seems like a pressing issue, that there is not enough supply and too much demand.
That's right. So part of the issue is supply, for sure. And I'll get to that. That's probably the biggest issue. But there's also the challenge of, like, the fact that the rules didn't make it clear how to get on a wait list, how to review the wait list if there's somebody on there who then has been there for 2 years and then maybe they left the island. Like, we don't have processes in place that have followed the rulemaking procedure to maybe clean the wait list when it's no longer representative of who's actually waiting for plots. Here's another thing. We're also proposing to move the wait list procedure to the city. Right now, it's managed by our volunteers, and it's burdensome. It's a lot of applications. It's a lot of stacks of paper. It's a lot of time in the day to be contacting people when a plot becomes available. Maybe they don't respond, or they take a while to respond. And we have to follow this first-come, first-serve policy to make it fair, and that can be really burdensome for our volunteers. So we're proposing to move it over to the city. That should make the wait lists move a little bit more quickly. It should make them a little bit more clear on how to even get on the wait list, for sure more fair, more transparent. And, you know, these are people's personal information sometimes when they put their name on the application. We don't necessarily want to deputize, you know, the public to be holding on to stacks of paper that you might find, like, on someone's dining room table. Whereas, you know, with the city, we're held to a certain standard of protecting people's information. We can eventually digitize it. We can put in resources to have these things on, like, a spreadsheet, maybe even eventually have it on our website as a way to sign up, so to streamline these things. So that kind of functionality of the waitlist process would hopefully reduce the wait time. And then, speaking to the supply, 11 community gardens, no new ones since the 90s. That's another reason my position was created, was to address capacity and expansion and to plan for expansion. So right now, we're contracting a geospatial analyst, and this should also be wrapping up pretty soon, to identify where on island we might want to prioritize. So as far as I know, and I don't have the history books of every single garden, I wish someday someone could do a history project and get, you know, written out how every garden was started. But I'm under the impression that they emerged because there was community voice and resource. And you do need community involvement, and we do want to respond to where there's need. But if you want to incorporate equity into the expansion process, then we can't just respond to where there's voice and resource. We should also be thinking about where, what parts of the island have been underserved in this program, and geographically, but also in terms of the people we're serving and other demographics. So that's something that we're doing with this geospatial analysis project. Once we get the results, we can sort of do this simultaneous planning that uses the results from this methodical analysis in addition to where a community has expressed interest, and pair those together and figure out where to expand to next.
Preliminarily, any communities that, you know, thinking about which places have been underrepresented that stand out?
The West Side definitely stands out, largely because we don't have any there, but also we see rapid population growth happening in Kapolei-Nava, and also people living in multi-unit housing, meaning they might not have access to yards. So that does stand out, but, you know, we're also looking at population density, we're looking at income, we're looking at where we have parks that could even support a garden, that have amenities that make gardening accessible, like bathrooms and accessibility and bus stops. So all of those factors, it's really too soon to say.
Yeah. And I know we've kind of been in the weeds about the ins and outs of running and managing gardens and these higher level questions, but I wanted to end on a kind of grounded, lighter note because this year, Governor Josh Green declared it the year of our community forests. There's a lot of talk and thought about what community gardening could mean. And I just wanted to know what to you are your favorite parts about community gardens and gardening and what brings you joy throughout this process?
Resiliency. I think community gardens are a super important response to crises like climate crises or even COVID. Like, this is a program, and not just ours, there are all kinds of community gardens throughout the state that aren't just within our program, that are providing space for people to grow food, grow plants, be in nature, touching the soil, and then in community, knowing their neighbors. That builds resiliency, that builds social capital. That is green space that might reduce the urban heat island effect. Like, I love gardens because they touch on so many different aspects of our life and our resiliency. And I'm especially, you know, amazed when I see people learning, you know, even if they aren't growing food to feed themselves, they are learning at least how to, because they're surrounding themselves with people who might have access to this seed or have knowledge about this particular plant, or, you know, will water their plants while they're gone. Like, there's a lot of knowledge sharing and just resource sharing that's happening in these gardens that, to me, means resiliency for our islands.
That was Anna Mines with the Honolulu Recreational Community Gardening Program. She was talking about the proposed rules and regulations, which need an update after 40 years. The public hearing to take testimony will take place from 5:30 to 7:30 this evening in Foster Botanical Gardens Conservatory Classroom. There will also be a virtual option to attend. Written testimony will be accepted. We'll have links on our website on how to provide input on the changes. Well, that's a wrap for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to talk to Representative Ed Case to get his perspective on the start of a new Congress and a second Trump administration. What are the issues that matter the most to you? Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.